Coming up on this week's book show, Lawrence Wright is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and New Yorker staff writer whose new book is The Plague Year, America in the Time of COVID. It's an all-encompassing account of the COVID epidemic, its origins, its wide-ranging repercussions, and the ongoing global fight to contain it. Lawrence Wright on this week's book show. Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Lawrence Wright is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and New Yorker staff writer whose new book is The Plague Year, America in the Time of COVID. It is an all-encompassing account of the COVID epidemic, its origins, its wide-ranging repercussions, and the ongoing global fight to contain it. Wright cuts through layers of misinformation and obfuscation, giving readers a clear-eyed assessment of this ongoing catastrophe and illuminates the medical, economic, political, and social ramifications of the pandemic. Lawrence Wright is a playwright, a screenwriter, and the author of 10 books of nonfiction, including The Looming Tower, which won the Pulitzer Prize. He was last with us just a year ago for his novel The End of October. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Lawrence Wright back to the book show.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's good to be on the show again.
Very nice to have you. So let us talk for a moment, because I don't believe in our conversation last April when we were talking about the novel The End of October, that when I asked you what was next, that you were going to write more about the about what we are living through, what we were living through in that year. So when did that all start to digest?
Well, in June of 2020, my editors at The New Yorker, David Remnick and Daniel Zaleski, called me. And they felt that the magazine had covered the pandemic, but, you know, glancingly, not, you know, not in a major way. And David likes to say he wanted a big, dumb story. He wanted to cover the waterfront. And I had been, honestly, Joe, I'd been avoiding, I didn't want to write more about it. I didn't want to write about the Trump administration. There were a lot of reasons that I had in my head. But when they called, I started thinking about how this pandemic has, it's like a tsunami. It's touched everything in our society, you know, race, politics, the economy, the culture, science, you know, that this is practically nothing that hasn't been changed by the pandemic. And so it became a challenge. How would I write about something so large and still make it personal?
You do make it personal, and we'll get to that in a moment. I'm interested in the time frame of it because, I mean, the title really tells you everything you need to know, The Plague Year, America and the Time of COVID. This book really looks at from the beginning of the year as the story of 2020, as the story and as the disease starts to emerge. And basically ends, at least the meat of the book ends with the election. So that's your year, and obviously the biggest month of that year is March, which you write most about. But obviously we're still in this, and it is, as I said in the introduction, this is ongoing. So you set for yourself some pretty tight parameters, I assume.
Yeah, you know, the year, actually, a little secret on this, Joe, The year in my mind, the clock starts on January 20th, 2020, when the first
Right.
case appears in Washington State, and it ends on precisely a year later with the inauguration. It's an interesting little calendar tidbit that in some respects, the start of the pandemic and the beginning of the end are both on the same date.
When you look at the research that you did for this book, knowing that the novel was at least intended to be speculative, and came out to be much more, and hit it pretty much on the head. But going into writing this, I assume you had a lot of baseline knowledge of what you were writing about when it came to pandemics.
Yeah, I mean, writing the novel did help prepare me to write, a nonfiction version because, I had quite an education in virology when I was working on the novel. And one of my teachers, this is so coincidental, it's hard to imagine, but Barney Graham at the National Institute of Allergies and Infectious Diseases, which is Dr. Fauci's shop, helped me when I was working on the novel design a virus that would pass muster with someone like him, something that would be real. And then when I wrote myself into a corner, he helped me cure it. So he's the guy who invented the vaccine that is in both the Pfizer and the Moderna shots. So he's, one of the great immunologists in history. And so I had his help with the novel and also his help with the nonfiction book.
And that is Barney Graham, who you say in the book is essentially a puzzle solver. When the actual pandemic struck, you write, he solved one of the most consequential puzzles in modern science, the chief architect of the first COVID vaccine. To say that when we talk about warp speed, but as you point out, this had been in the works for a long time.
Yeah, thanks to, just practical science, pure science. Barney was working on creating vaccines for several different diseases, including MERS, which was the Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, another coronavirus, which we're really lucky, it wasn't that one that became so contagious. It killed 35% of the people it infected. So Barney was working on a vaccine like a similar type of vaccine. So from the moment they got the genetic sequence, right around the mid-January, to the point where the shot is going into arms of people in a test trial was 3 months. And, at the time, people were talking about a vaccine that would finally be ready in the fall of this year. Can you imagine what our society would be like if we still didn't have a vaccine, and it would be with all these variants racing around, it would be a terrible nightmare. So we owe Barney Graham and Jason McClellan, his number two in that lab, a tremendous vote of thanks.
There is a chapter, the second chapter of the book is The Trickster. It took me a few minutes to realize that ultimately that's the disease, right?
Yeah, it comes in so many different guises, and it affects people so differently. And one of the confounding things about the coronavirus, this particular one, SARS-CoV-2, which is the virus that causes COVID-19. What we didn't understand at the beginning is that most of the people who are infected are asymptomatic. And in other words, they carry the virus, they spread the virus, but they don't even know that they're infected. And, had we known that earlier, we might have approached this disease quite differently.
Lawrence Wright is our guest this week on the book show. The name of the new book is The Plague Year, America in the Time of COVID. It is published by Knopf. As I was reading it, it's weird how you forget. It's weird what you forget. And suddenly a lot of the anger came back to me. Whether that was suppressing it or disguising it, I don't know. But I remembered that it happened. And yet it, when I listened, when I was reading this and I heard it, I thought, oh my goodness, I can't believe, you keep saying to yourself, I can't believe that happened just a few months ago.
Yeah. There is the, you know, quality of it all being a blur. But I think also the reason that, you know, you emotionally connect is that when you finally see it all in one long story, one piece together, you know, and you see this, how it evolved and all the failures and the might have beens, the depth of the tragedy begins to make itself apparent. And to me, the thing that was most striking in writing the book and researching is the unacknowledged grief that, you know, for the loved ones that have been lost, and also for, in some ways, for the country that has been so humbled by this onslaught.
David Halberstam, who I had the honor of interviewing several times, talked about writing books as things were unfolding, and writing what journalists have called that first rough draft of history. That's essentially what this is, right? I mean, this is our first look as a reminder of a baseline of what happened in calendar year 2020.
You know, I think that journalism, you know, sort of surfs the wave of history. And when you're the reporter covering an event that is historic, you realize that the shards of memories and experiences that you pick up are what historians are going to depend upon. And, you know, memories fade, people die, you know, there's a pressing need while this event is still alive in people's minds to gather what you can. And that's, I'm very conscious of that. And also, I, as a writer, I feel so privileged to be able to talk to people and get their stories and try to spin them into some sort of coherent narrative before they're gone.
Let's take Anthony Fauci, for example. I believe you say you interviewed him in July of last year.
Yeah, several times, not just then.
But that was one of the interviews that you write about in the book. And again, everything's moving and everything is changing. So what was said in March may be different than April and July, but that's because things change so quickly, not only in the United States of America, but around the world.
Public health officials had to adjust their thinking about the disease that they were dealing with. Dr. Fauci and others in the public health community were under the assumption at the beginning that this was going to be like the flu, a worse version of the flu. But the truth is that COVID-19 is a very different disease and far more serious than the flu. Or at least most flus. Also, you know, the asymptomatic transmission, the many different forms of that the disease takes in different peoples, you know, cardiac problems, pulmonary problems, even mental problems, you know, just there's a tremendous range. It affects people differently. It affects different ages differently. And, you know, all of that was something that the scientists had to learn as the public was also learning. And I think that that contributed to a lot of the distrust because some of the assumptions about this disease were wrong at the beginning and had to be changed.
You write in the book, America would have three distinct opportunities to curb the COVID contagion before it got out of hand. The first was lost when the Chinese rejected the U.S. offer to send a team of disease detectives to investigate the outbreak. And then the testing fiasco marked the second failed opportunity that America had to control the COVID contagion. And the testing fiasco is really one of those things that brought out that emotion of, oh, right. Wow, that was really screwed up, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. And, you know, first of all, it was delayed because the Chinese did not send us a sample of the virus. You know, in order to have a test, you need a sample of the virus as a control to make sure you're testing against the right thing. And to this day, as far as I know, they've never sent a sample of the virus. And so it wasn't until that first infection appeared in Washington State, January 20th of 2020, that the starting gun began for the test. And, you know, the Germans created a test right off the bat that preceded the one the CDC accomplished a day or so later. But the CDC test, they knew when they sent it out. This is the thing that I guess I have the hardest time understanding. Before they sent that test out, the people who created it had recognized that it was going to fail at least 30% of the time. And public health labs discovered this right away. Because one of the first things you do when you receive a test is you try it against something you know is sterile, like, you know, water that has been purified. And, you know, in the water, they were finding it, saying that it had, you know, antibodies to COVID-19. So they knew that they were getting false positives. And CDC went back to work on it, and they told the FDA, well, we have it in a week, and then it was going to be 2 weeks. And then finally they said they didn't know when they were going to have the test ready. And so the FDA sent Timothy Stenzel, a really highly qualified expert, to CDC to see what was going on. And he arrived on Saturday afternoon. They wouldn't let him in. And then on Sunday, they let him in, but there wasn't anybody in the lab because it was the weekend. And finally, on Monday, he gets to go into the lab. And what does he find? The room where they're preparing the test is the same room where they're also analyzing samples that have been sent in to CDC for analysis. So there is, the disease is in the same room with the test. And it, you know, this is something that is, you know, it moves around very easily. It floats through the air. And so, you know, somebody walking in the room with a lab coat might carry the virus outside just on the coat. So it was perfectly obvious to the FDA guy that, you know, the solution was to get this out of the CDC and put it in another lab where it wasn't contaminated. And after that, we did get the test. But, you know, weeks were lost as the disease was rampaging across the country, and we were totally blind to the spread.
You write in the book, the confusion of authority that would characterize every step that the Trump administration took in the pandemic was evident from the beginning. You mention many characters that are in this book, and one that we follow from the beginning to the end of this plague year, but also from the time he lands in the White House to the day that he cleans out his desk and rolls up the map on his wall and walks out the door, is Matthew Pottinger. He makes regular appearances throughout this narrative. Tell us about Matthew and why he was so compelling to you to follow.
Well, he's like an ideal source, Joe. It was hard to believe that I was so fortunate with not just with Matt, but in so many of the cases, people that I was able to talk to. Matt was a reporter for the Wall Street Journal in China during the first SARS outbreak in 2002 to 2003. He speaks fluent Mandarin. And then, as it happens, his wife was a top flight virologist at CDC, and his brother is an epidemiologist at the University of Washington, where the first case appeared in Seattle. So perfectly situated in so many respects. And then what was most interesting, you know, he started hearing in January reports of what was happening in China. And, you know, the Chinese were saying it wasn't a human disease, it wasn't transmissible. And, you know, and these raised alarm bells because similar things had happened in 2003 when When SARS arose, the Chinese actually hid patients from world health authorities. They put them in ambulances and taxis until the authorities were gone. So Matt, acting not just as the deputy national security advisor, but in his role as a former reporter, started calling sources in China and talking to doctors, and they were telling him that they had community spread. In other words, it was out of control and that it spread asymptomatically. And also, the best way of containing the spread was to use masks. So all of these things with, Matt started the coronavirus task force. He did all of this in the White House. He was the very first person to wear a mask in the White House. And he said it was as if he was wearing a clown nose. People were gawking at him. The president asked if he was sick. And he said, "No, I just don't want to be the first guy that knocked off a president with a communicable disease." But he turned out to be a linchpin in the nation's strategy to contain this horrible pandemic.
As you said at the beginning, you did not intend to write a book about the Trump administration, and yet it's hard to write this story without writing about the Trump administration. And you say what Trump proved to us is that we weren't the people we thought we were. The things we said we cared about weren't the things we really cared about. It says a lot.
Well, it was fascinating to me to see, going back to the Republican primaries in 2016, which was the largest field and the most diverse in political American political history. And Donald Trump, an outsider with a lot of baggage, probably that was also a historic amount of baggage as well. He mowed them down one by one and then won the presidential election. A sexual predator in the Me Too era running against a woman who was highly qualified. All of those things were surprising. I think the whole country, even Trump himself, was surprised by the outcome. But people were voting for other things.
But when it comes to COVID itself and his handling of it, as you say in the book, by his words and his example, the president became not a leader, but a saboteur.
This is a guy who was asked to introduce the mask ordinance, to persuade Americans to wear a mask. And so he stood up at a coronavirus task force meeting and said, "We now know that masks are effective. I've been told that they're safe and this sort of thing, and the people should wear it. I'm not going to wear it, but you should wear it." And so he immediately undermined the last chance we had really to do anything substantial to stop the spread of the disease. He also, the Trump administration had done a study of early at the beginning of the administration. They did this tabletop exercise called the Crimson Contagion. And the scenario was a traveler returns from China. He's coughing. He comes home to Chicago. His son goes to a rock concert. 6 months later, 500,000 Americans are dead. This is eerily, creepily similar to what actually happened. And the tabletop exercise showed how confounded the federal response was going to be. There would be no leadership. The governors would be at odds with each other. The national storehouse was depleted. The longer this went on, the more bollocks everything became. Every single thing that was in that tabletop exercise happened. And Robert Cadillac, who was the HHS administrator who led the exercise, said we had seen the movie already and we knew it was going to have a bad ending. And yet they didn't take the lessons from their own experiments.
The people that you write about, obviously there are people like Matt Pottinger who come out as real, I think, real heroes. Trump comes out as very inept in the story and in your reporting of it. But then there are the people that are hard to define, like, well, Anthony Fauci, who you talk about some of the statements that he says very early on in February and March of 2020, which the president regularly brings up, that were proven not to be true. And that opinion, I will say, in reading it, maybe changed or was tweaked for me a little bit. Deborah Birx, I think, comes out a little bit better, especially as you tell us about this incredible road trip that she took in the late summer and fall of 2020, and going to communities and trying to get people to mask up, even though the president was telling people not to, and she was frustrated because she was no longer really said, I'm done with the task force. And Robert Redfield, who you look at and say, okay, was he really the right guy to be in the room at that moment?
Well, you know, you're talking about the public health community, which, you know, is composed of human beings. They're not prophets, they're scientists. And they were faced with a disease that we had no treatment for and no vaccine for. This was something that every single one of them had anticipated. When I was working on the novel, I talked to many of the people in the public health community. And, you know, I asked them, you know, would we be any better prepared than our ancestors were in 1918 if a novel virus like this came along? And the answer was no. Without treatments, without a vaccine, then you're left with what are called non-pharmaceutical interventions, such as masking and hand washing and social distancing, which is what they did a century ago. A century ago, they scarcely knew what a virus was. You know, our science is far ahead of that. But the assumptions, some of these verities that were built into the public health mindset, such as travel bans, are ineffective. By the time you imply that you're going to do it, the disease is probably already transmitted. And also it interferes with trade and free movement of doctors and so on. Well, that turned out to be something that they had to re-examine, because thousands of people were arriving from China to the U.S. every month at a time when internal travel in China had been essentially shut down. You know, it was an open door to the disease. And the same thing was true with Europe when Italy became overrun with the COVID-19. So it was Matt Pottinger, once again, who advocated for the travel bans, which were very important, and which were opposed initially by members of the public health community, including Dr. Fauci and Redfield and others. But they came around. They began to see that this was a principle of public health that, in light of this current pandemic, didn't hold up. And the same thing was true with masks. You had the Surgeon General saying, don't buy masks, people. What a thing for a Surgeon General to say. But, you know, he was thinking, once again, through the framework of influenza. Flu is spread, you know, largely through droplets. You know, you remember the whole droplet theory. That's why you stood 6 feet apart. You know, if you're standing far enough apart, you don't need a mask. But this disease spreads through aerosols. I mean, it floats on the air. If you think about someone speaking or breathing in cold weather and you see this vapor cloud, that's more like what, if you could see the spread of the viral particles, that would be what COVID-19 looked like.
Lawrence Wright's new book is The Plague Year, America in the Time of COVID. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuc produces our program, Bookmark Us for Next Week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.